the continent's most violent country, a phrase used in BBC News this week in reference to Ecuador, which just passed a major referendum that gives its president the power to fully unleash Ecuador's military and justice system on organized crime.
I have to say that Ecuador has been a very peaceful country until very recently. Like, you had a very violent Peru, very violent Colombia, but Ecuador was very peaceful. Like, I saw two presidents fall in Ecuador and almost no one was killed. Correa was, as I said, leftist and nationalist, so he decided to close a military base that the United States had in the Ecuadorian coast. And that military base was controlling a lot of the drug traffic. Drugs were not traditionally produced in Ecuador, and I think they are not produced to this day, as far as I know. What happens is that some of the Mexican cartels were able to move there. There are like two factors. Some of the Mexican cartels moved to Ecuador, and also when Colombia signs the peace process with the guerrillas, with the FARC, some of the guerrillas were supporting themselves with drug production and trafficking. Mm-hmm. And some of the people don't sign the peace agreement, and they become like kind of, they stay being like narco traffickers. And some people call this the resource curse. But because of having a lot of power coming from oil money, he was able to create a stronger and perhaps more authoritarian government. But basically, the lawsuit was about Texaco using substandard technology and then strongly polluting the environment and destroying the environment in the Ecuadorian Amazon. While they, like in their fields in the United States and other places, they were using cleaner technology that didn't create those problems. It's a little bit different. One thing that I always tell my students who are American is that in general in Latin America, but especially in Ecuador, indigenous people don't like to be called tribes. They call themselves nationalities because they find tribes offensive. I could say that Ecuador, up to the present, is a very colonial kind of country.
Up to the present? Still? Did you know that when European settlers of Ecuador and their descendants sold their land, called haciendas, the indigenous people who lived on that land were sold along with the land? For reasons you'll find out in this episode, Ecuador's indigenous people were constantly indebted to the landowner, and this debt was passed down to their children. And after Ecuador won its independence from Spain, even though its indigenous peoples became citizens of Ecuador, they still couldn't vote or get elected to any office. As you'll note, some of this history may bear some eerie resemblance to America's Jim Crow. Hey there, News Peelers. Today is April 24, 2024, and this is Adele, your host at the History Behind News podcast. Aren't you tired of the repetitive news on TV and social media? They just go over the same dramatized developments all day long. Do you ever wonder what happened before our news? I mean, how do we get here? They say if you don't know your history, you're bound to repeat it. So while others cover the news, I uncover its history. I call this peeling the history behind news, which we accomplish in weekly conversations with distinguished scholars who delve deep into history to give us their fascinating perspectives from our past. I'm committed to making in-depth history that are researched and written by scholars, enjoyable and accessible to everyone. So grab a cup of coffee or your favorite drink or both, and let's get into it. Daniel Noboa became Ecuador's president this past November, but it didn't take long for him to declare the obvious in January that Ecuador is ravaged by an internal armed conflict. Accordingly, he ordered the Ecuadorian military to neutralize the country's gangs. And just this Sunday, Ecuadorians gave President Noboa even more powers to fight drug trafficking gangs. Specifically, the military's presence on the streets and in prisons will become law, and prison sentences will lengthen for some offenses related to organized crime. thanks to highly organized international criminal groups such as Mexican narcos, as well as some local gangs, this once peaceful country of 17 million now finds itself at the center of the global drug trade. Of course, there are grave consequences here. You have surely noticed the surge of Ecuadorians at our border with Mexico, and I don't think you missed the dramatic footage earlier this year of masked gunmen holding the staff of a TV station in Ecuador hostage on live TV. By the way, in a news development that I won't get into too much here, but is sure worth mentioning, Mexico broke its diplomatic ties with Ecuador after President Noboa ordered the arrest of Ecuador's former vice president, who had taken refuge in the Mexican embassy in Quito, Ecuador's capital. You should check this out online. You'll see images of Ecuadorian police in military gear entering Mexico's embassy in Quito, which is a pretty extraordinary development in international relations. To better understand how Ecuador got here, I spoke with Dr. Carmen Martinez Novo, a professor at the Center for Latin American Studies in the University of Florida and the editor-in-chief of the Latin American Research Review. Her research interests, which perfectly fit our discussion in this episode, include race and ethnicity, political anthropology, indigenous politics and rights, political ecology and anthropology of the state and elite. And her geographic expertise include Ecuador, the Andes, Amazon, and Mexico, areas that we'll also talk about in this episode. Finally, in our conversation, we'll draw lessons from Dr. Martinez Novo's 2021 book titled Undoing Multiculturalism, Resource Extraction and Indigenous Rights in Ecuador, which tells the counterintuitive story, yes, the counterintuitive story of how multiculturalism declined under Ecuador's President Correa, even though he was part of the so-called turn to the left in Latin America. During Korea's presidency, colonial legacies returned, and state authoritarianism grew. This paradoxical reversal of multiculturalism is intertwined with other tragic developments, and Dr. Martinez Novo will tell us how violence erupted and engulfed Ecuador. To learn more about Dr. Martinez Novo and her extensive research, you can visit her academic homepage, the link for which is provided in the detailed caption of this episode. So, stay with me as Dr. Martinez Novo and I peel the history behind this news. Even though Chile has an advanced economy, similar to Ecuador, ethnic justice and indigenous conflicts are a major issue there. And in fact, they have been in full display throughout Chile's failed attempts to draft a constitution to replace Pinochet's dictatorship-era charter. In Season 2, Episode 38, Dr. Claudio Fuentes of the Diego Portales University in Chile explains Chile's tumultuous political history, including the 1973 coup d'etat that toppled and killed Salvador Allende and placed Pinochet at the helm. He also describes the CIA's involvement in that coup. I learned many points that I hadn't appreciated about Chile's history, including its highly polarized politics. On that specific point, Dr. Fuentes even draws parallels between Chile, Brazil, and the United States of America. I've dropped a link for you to my conversation with Dr. Fuentes. Now, let's get back to our conversation with Dr. Martinez Novo about Ecuador. Dr. Martinez Novo, it's a pleasure to have you on our program. Thank you for taking the time for this conversation with me.
Thank you, Adele, for the invitation and the opportunity.
Sure. I want to begin our conversation with a basic question that may turn out not to be so basic after all. And this is it. Who are the people of Ecuador?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a very, very good question. And as you say, it's not as simple as it seems. So Ecuador is, they call themselves a plurinational country.
Plurinational, like plural.
Plurinational. So they have different nations. Mm-hmm. So they have like 13 different indigenous groups. And the groups call themselves nations because they have a territory and a particular language. And the largest group is the Quechua nationality. And they have 13 peoples among themselves. So it's like a variety of different peoples, languages. And then you have, obviously, Ecuador was, let's say, conquered by Spanish colonialism in the 16th century. And then after that, you also have people from Europe living in Ecuador. But it's even more multicultural. There is also migrations to Ecuador from the Middle East of Syrio-Lebanese origin, for instance. A couple of presidents of Ecuador were of Syrio-Lebanese origin.
Oh, wow.
For instance, Abdallah Bucaram was one of them, and the other was Jamil Mawad. And they are from the coast of Ecuador, and there is a Jewish immigration also after the Second World War. So it's very, very diverse.
How about Japanese?
European migration and indigenous nations. And also there is Afro-Ecuadorians that I can talk more about.
Afro-Ecuadorians. How about Japanese immigration? I remember seeing a lot of Japanese, relatively a lot, in Peru.
Peru, yeah, but it's not as much in Ecuador. Peru
has
more Japanese and Chinese immigration than Ecuador. There is a little bit of Chinese in Ecuador, but not as numerous as it can be in Brazil or in Peru.
So is there a dominant...
So I think the immigration, apart from the Mediterranean, is more like in the Syro-Lebanese and Jewish immigration, more than Asian.
Asian, I see. Is there a... I'm searching for the right word to use here. I'll just use this. Is there a dominant culture
in Ecuador?
Yeah.
Well, it's a colonial country, so the people, let's say the settlers of the colonial metropolis would be the dominant population, people who originally came from Spain, but also from Portugal, Italy, some other places, but mostly from Spain.
So I see. You talked about 13 different indigenous nations in the U.S. Mm-hmm. We also have, Native American nations. Is that similar to the 13 indigenous nations in Ecuador, or do they have different rights?
It's a little bit different. One thing that I always tell my students who are American is that in general in Latin America, but especially in Ecuador, indigenous people don't like to be called tribes. They call themselves nationalities because they find tribes offensive. So Americans shouldn't call indigenous people tribes. And they have been, they have traditional territories. Differently from the United States, they never were concentrated in reservations.
Oh.
They live in communities there, and they also have territories. And they have a long history of political of uprisings and political organization that I can talk more about because that's my specialty.
Oh, I see. Before we get to history of uprisings and political involvement, I know you've written about multiculturalism. Now we talked about a pluralistic nation, if you will. Are these also different ethnicities within the indigenous peoples?
Yeah, like there is 13 different languages. Mm-hmm. So there are some languages that are more like spoken by more people, which is Quechua. Is the Ecuadorian dialect of Quechua, which was the language of the Incas, spoken also in Peru and throughout the Andes. And then you have another large group is the Shuar, who used to be called the Jíbaros before. They speak what ethnologists used to call Jíbaroan languages. And they are also a large group. And then there are smaller groups in the Amazon, like the Sequoia, the Guarani, different smaller groups. Some of the languages are spoken only by like 200, 300 people.
Oh, so very small.
But Quechua is a large one, and Shuar is another large language.
I remember hearing Quechua being spoken in Peru when I was there. Mm-hmm. Whenever we speak about other countries, us Americans, we always strain to draw some parallels to America mm-hmm. because it helps us understand. Here in the U.S., we deal with a history of racism and repression towards our Native American countrymen and women. Is that similar to Ecuador?
I think there are similarities and also differences. I could say that Ecuador, up to the present, is a very colonial kind of country.
Up to the present, still?
Well, in the kind of the way people interact, in the behaviors and interactions, and that's part of what I talk, I write about in my recent book. I'll explain why. In Ecuador, European settlers, they accumulated land, and they had like large properties that were called haciendas.
Haciendas,
and these
okay.
large properties, they had indigenous workers in them. And these indigenous workers, they were assigned a nominal salary, but most of the time they were not paid a salary. They were given like a small plot of land in exchange for working the land of the landowner. And in exchange for this small plot of land, not only the head of household, but also his whole family had to work for the landowner, including cooking, cleaning the house for the women and the daughters, and also milking the cows and everything. And all this work was done without a salary, just for the usufruct of a plot of land. People, when a landowner sold a hacienda, they sold the land with the indigenous people in it. Indigenous people couldn't move from one property to another, mostly because they owed money to the landowner. Even though they had to work without being paid, the landowner gave them some things like seeds or agrarian implements, or they gave them a piece of clothing a year. And then the worker was indebted to the landowner for these things. And if the worker was, shepherding, it was similar to what happened in other places in Latin America. It's called debt peonage. So they were, even though they were not paid for their labor, they were on top of that indebted. And children inherited the debts from their parents. So it was very similar. And then the landowner had jurisdiction over the workers. So they could judge them, and they could punish them and whip them with the whip. So it was very, very similar to slavery. But it was different in the sense that the indigenous people were not a commodity or property of the owner. But apart from that, they couldn't move. They had to work for free, and they could be punished with the whip and all that. So it was very close to slavery. It was kind of more similar, perhaps, to a medieval European serfdom.
Yeah, I was just thinking of the Imperial Russia in the early 1800s.
Yeah, it was
and
very
earlier.
Similar to European serfdom. And then, so this system lasted in Ecuador until 1964. Like my own
1964?
Yes, so wow. Let's say my mother-in-law knows this system. My husband, who is he's 63, as a child he lived through this system.
So, goodness.
It's like all their indigenous people have lived through this system. So there is the memory is very close. So at that time, indigenous people, there were also like regulations of who could, even though like when Ecuador becomes independent from Spain, and that's in the early 19th century, they become an independent nation. So indigenous people, nominally, they become citizens, but they are not active citizens. They are passive citizens, meaning similar to African Americans, meaning that they cannot vote or be elected because there were particular requirements for voting. One of them was the literacy requirement. In order to vote, you had to be able to read and write in Spanish. And they were not allowed to go to school or read and write. And they didn't know Spanish. They knew their own language. Therefore, they couldn't vote. So the first time that indigenous people are able to vote in Ecuador is when, after the dictatorship in 1979, they vote
for the
first time. So I'm telling that so you get an idea of how colonial this can be. But in a way, it's parallel to the United States because of this legacy of something close to slavery. I mean, there was also African slavery for Afro-descendant people in Ecuador, but it was abolished early in the 19th century. There was some slavery.
You mentioned Afro-Ecuadorians. What percentage of population is that?
Well, that's a debate, but I think in the last census, they were about 7% of the population. Okay.
That's still sizable, 7%.
Yeah, and they are concentrated in some regions of the country, particularly in the northern coast and in a section of the highlands. And it's very interesting because the Afro-Ecuadorians in the northern coast were mostly people who escaped slavery in Colombia. So they are mostly Maroon people, like people who were free in Ecuador, who live in the jungles on their own.
Yeah,
and they even had an independent kingdom in the 16th century, 17th century in the north of Ecuador. But then you have the people in the highlands that are Afro-Ecuadorian. They were brought by the Jesuits, by the missionaries who had sugar plantations. Mm-hmm. So you have like two different populations of Afro-Ecuadorians, the ones who live freely in the jungles and the ones who were enslaved by the Jesuit priests in the highlands. Yeah.
That's interesting. We could have a whole podcast on that, Dr. Martinez Novo. We'll be back after a short break to talk about the undoing of multiculturalism and your book. We'll be right back. You can put a face to these podcasts by visiting our YouTube channels, youtube.com/@historybehindnews, and also youtube.com/@unraveling the Middle East. I've also dropped links to these YouTube channels below. Now, let's get back to peeling the history behind our news. Dr. Martinez Novo, you mentioned your book in the last segment. It's titled Undoing Multiculturalism, Resource Extraction and Indigenous Rights in Ecuador. I'd love to talk more about it. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Adele. So that book was published in 2021, and there is a translation into Spanish if somebody is interested, published with Abby Ayala as El Desmantelamiento del Multiculturalismo. The book is looks at indigenous organization and indigenous disorganization, like the rise and perhaps decline of the indigenous movement in Ecuador. And is historical. It goes from the 1970s all the way to the 21st century. But the way I look at the indigenous political organization is not as if indigenous people were isolated, but in kind of a articulation with their allies. So there are chapters on the different allies. There is an author who is also a friend, Joan Rapaport. She said that indigenous movements are not really only indigenous, they are actually intercultural. Like they are made up of indigenous people, but also by allies, like people of the left, like missionaries, like anthropologists, different people who kind of help indigenous people, supported them in their struggles, helped them organize.
So it becomes a political movement.
Yeah, it's like, well, maybe like any social movement, but yeah. Many people think that they organize independently. And one of the things I argue is that the kind of collaboration between indigenous and their allies has been not explored enough because people don't want to emphasize that indigenous people were like in interaction with others, that because there is the stereotype that they could have been manipulated or guided by other people. But I mean, that interaction exists. And if you look at the movements, you find it. But authors have not wanted to emphasize it too much to show the indigenous more as independent. But in my book, I look at their interactions with different groups. So I have a chapter, for instance, about the missionaries, which are very important Catholic missionaries, particularly liberation theology, very radical leftist priests who work with indigenous people in Ecuador. The political left, particularly the Communist Party, was very important in organizing indigenous people. I have found indigenous collaborators or colleagues who speak Russian and studied in the Soviet Union, for instance.
Oh, wow.
So you find that.
So we're looking at the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. Not anymore, right?
Not anymore, but it used to be like, when kind of social movements in Latin America went to the Patricio Lumumba University in Moscow to study. You have the influence of the church, you have the left, but I have a chapter also about non-governmental organizations and anthropologists and ethnolinguists and how they have worked with indigenous people. So it's my book is about all those interactions. And I also look at three historical periods. First, the period from the 1970s to the 60s, the 70s, when the indigenous movements gets organized. And there is an agrarian reform in Ecuador, and there are many social changes, for instance, the abolition of servitude. Then I look at the period of neoliberalism when the state retrenches and indigenous, interestingly, with the state becoming weaker under neoliberalism, the indigenous movement of Ecuador becomes stronger with the help of the left and the missionaries. And I have to say that the indigenous movement of Ecuador was called the strongest in Latin America. It was the first movement that was able to unify at the national level. And they were able to oust several presidents. Like, they would go to the streets and the president would fall several times. So they were very, very powerful. Every time the government tried to stop subsidizing gas and oil or stop having social policies, they would go to the streets and oust the government. So it's a very powerful, or it used to be. Because then I look at the government of Correa and there were some changes, some political changes there. Well, Correa has been very influential because with all this political instability that I'm talking about, a lot of Ecuadorian presidents in the period of neoliberalism didn't last more than 2 years. They were ousted by social movements. They would last 2 years, then they were ousted, somebody else came in. And Correa was very different. He was a stronger president, and he lasted 10 years from 2007 to 2017.
Is that like 2 terms?
He left a lot of influence.
Is that like 2 terms of presidency?
It was 3, I believe.
Three, I see.
It was 3 because there was a constituent assembly. He didn't last 3 full periods, but it was 3 terms.
I see.
And he was a very strong president because he also, and you probably know a lot about this, because it has some parallels with the Middle East too, but the price of oil was very high and the price of commodities when he was a president, and that gave him a lot of power. And some people call this the resource curse, but because of having a lot of power coming from oil money, he was able to create a stronger and perhaps more authoritarian government. He was a president of the left, but I can explain more what kind of left he was.
I just want to clarify, get one point before I go back and ask more clarifying questions. First is, Ecuador's main export is what? Gas or oil?
Well, Ecuador has had several exports throughout history. One strong export at the end of the 19th century was cocoa, like chocolate. Then it was bananas in the 1950s. Mm-hmm. And later, oil became the biggest export of it's an oil country. And a lot of the revenue of the government comes from oil. People used to pay very little taxes there because it's an oil country. Okay. They also export shrimp and some other things, flowers. But oil was the main revenue until the prices of oil went completely down. But in the period of Correa, the prices of oil were very, very high. So there was a lot of revenue at that moment.
I want to make sure I understand one thing that you said in the beginning of this segment. You were talking about how other researchers or authors talk about, I don't know if this is the word you use, it's the word I'm going to use, how indigenous people may have been manipulated by other groups to form political mm-hmm. movements. I don't think you used the word manipulation, but in any event, you get my point. But that's not your conclusion. Your conclusion is that they were able to form alliances. Did I summarize your point correctly?
Yeah, that's correct. I say that it's not, but people don't want to emphasize sometimes the alliances because they think the alliances can detract from the independence or of indigenous political movements.
The title of your book is interesting. You say Undoing Multiculturalism. You know, we talked about multiculturalism in the last segment. I want to revisit it again in the context of your book's title. What does that mean, undoing multiculturalism? Why do you say that?
Yeah, well, during the period in which the indigenous movement was very powerful, they were able to change completely the Ecuadorian state. There were two constitutions in which Ecuador recognized indigenous peoples, recognized their territories, recognized their right to have independent systems of education in their own languages, and recognized also their right to self-rule, have their own legal systems, like sub-national legal systems. So they had a lot of autonomy, and the indigenous organizations managed the education system, and they even had their own system of health that was indigenous, based on indigenous practices.
This sounds good, doesn't it?
Yeah, so because they were such a powerful movement. But under Correa, it's very interesting difficult to explain because Correa was mostly like what some authors have called a populist government. So the Correa government claimed to be including indigenous people. For instance, the 2008 constitution recognizes the country as being plurinational and intercultural, and it provides like further rights to indigenous people. But at the same time, Correa was very authoritarian, and he didn't want to have social movements that were independent or autonomous or that could oust governments, for instance, or presidents. So he started to kind of divide and weaken the indigenous movement. And one way was through the control of the education system, because the education system was not only about educating indigenous children in their own languages. The teachers were also political leaders in their communities. Mm-hmm. And the system also taught about their struggles and kind of taught people to be political. So one thing that Correa did was to take the educational system out of the hands of the indigenous organizations and centralize it in the hands of the Ministry of Education.
That's interesting. In a way, by including them in the bigger culture, he was actually decreasing their autonomy and their own cultural identity, their ability to exert their independence.
And then another thing that he did is indigenous people had schools in every community, and Correa decided that the community schools were schools of poverty. They only had one teacher for all the different grades. So he decided to concentrate the schools, like close all the community schools and concentrate the schools in bigger towns. But and he created the schools with, according to him, he was going to provide better teachers, better technology, more computers, internet for the schools. He was going to modernize. But at the same time that he concentrated and modernized the schools, he didn't allow the schools to be in the indigenous communities, took these leaders out of the communities. And also he had like a standardized exam for all the teachers, and the indigenous teachers mostly didn't pass the exam because was not relevant to their culture or to them. So basically it's like he kind of centralized the education, and he stopped using the school system stopped using the books in the indigenous languages and went back to using Spanish. So there was a whole kind of change towards, again, centralization and the imposition of the dominant culture.
That's why the title of your book is Undoing Multiculturalism. I get it. By sort of including him, he also undermined their own cultures, kind of wanted to create one homogenous culture almost based through education.
Yeah, he tried to go back to previous ideas of having just one culture, but his purpose was also to control politically the country, because the indigenous organizations had created a lot of instability before.
Yeah.
And he wanted to control that. And what, another thing that I say is originally he claimed indigeneity, like the idea of indigeneity a lot. Like he spoke a little bit of Quechua. He used a shared with indigenous kind of motifs. But at the same time, he started to focus all his development policies on expanding oil production and later mining also. And that kind of clashed with the indigenous movement. So once he started to clash because he was promoting oil extraction and mining, he started to prosecute and delegitimize the leadership of the indigenous movement. And he tried to make contact with the communities directly, but tried to kind of prosecute the leaders. So he had a lot of lawsuits against the indigenous leaders for terrorism. And
wow.
It was very contradictory because
on the
one hand, he claimed to represent the indigenous people. He claimed that the leaders were corrupt. So it was a very populist strategy of a kind of the legitimizing the organizations and the leaders, and at the same time claiming to represent the grassroots of the indigenous people. So it's very complicated. My chapters are a little bit, you have to read a lot through the details because people think that this government was really good for indigenous people because that's what they claim abroad.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at what they actually did in their policies, is very different. They had a policy of centralization, of repression, of division of indigenous organizations.
No, you explained it beautifully here. I get it. We talked about oil here, and mm-hmm. you also mentioned former President Correa's lawsuits of indigenous communities. Let's take a break here. And then the next segment, I want to talk to you about this famous lawsuit, the Chevron lawsuit that I've been mm-hmm. following for years. Actually, I should correct that. I don't think it's years. I think it's probably two decades. Yeah. And we'll be back after a break.
We hope you are enjoying this podcast. And if you are, then why not treat us to a cup of coffee? That's right. For the price of a cup of coffee, you too can become a monthly supporter of the History Behind News podcast. We rely on your support to continue this program, to continue peeling the history behind our news. Supporting us is easy. Just click the support link in the detailed caption of this episode. And while you're there, check out the information about our guests and other attributions and links. And thank you.
Dr. Martinez Novo, I'd love to hear the history or at least your take on this famous Chevron case from Ecuador that's lasted, what, 2.5 decades now or something?
Yeah, no, it's crazy. It's difficult to follow even for specialists because it has lasted many years and it's like a labyrinth because it's not even one lawsuit, it's several lawsuits at the same time.
I started law school shortly after it was started. I think it was 94 or 95 and it was a Harvard lawyer or something like that. That's details. That doesn't matter. What is this about? All I know is that the indigenous community is heavily involved in this.
Mm-hmm. So it's a lawsuit that was started by talking about alliances. It was an alliance of indigenous people, also poor peasants from the Amazon, with environmental groups, Ecuadorian and international, and some other kind of allies that they had. So it was also intercultural in terms of like being an alliance of different political forces. I think the lawsuit is difficult to follow. There is a movie about it, but it's an older movie, and then there were more developments. It's called Crude, and it's interesting to watch.
Mm-hmm.
There have been developments after the movie. But it started before... And it started in New York. okay. originally as a lawsuit of indigenous people of the Amazon, other poor peasants and environmentalists, both Ecuadorian and U.S. center in New York. But it seems that the Texaco at some point decided that the New York court didn't have jurisdiction.
Okay.
And they decided to move the lawsuit to Ecuador, probably because they thought they are going to be able to control the lawsuit better in Ecuador. It's easier to maybe bribe a judge or something. That's what perhaps they thought. So the lawsuit in Ecuador starts in 2003.
Okay.
What happened is that they were lucky because while the Texaco that then changed to Chevron, Texaco was bought by Chevron. So the lawsuit started as being with Texaco and then it ended up being with Chevron. So it went to Ecuador, but they have the bad luck that this president, Rafael Correa, again, is elected in 2006. And he's like a very nationalist, populist, left president. So he kind of starts to renegotiate the contracts with the oil companies. He's very focused on oil, but like other governments of the left in Latin America, like also Evo Morales and or Hugo Chavez of Venezuela, they were allies at the time. Even though they were focused on natural resource extraction, they renegotiated the contract with the foreign companies so that their own countries got more revenue from the oil.
Okay.
Like in the neoliberal period, the country would get 5% and the companies would get 95%. But under these governments, the governments were able to renegotiate and they were getting like 60 or something percent. So it was like a better for the Latin American countries. And then he kind of started to intervene in this lawsuit.
Before we go any further, I'm interested to know some basic stuff about this lawsuit. What was the environmental grievance? What was the environmental issue that got this started?
Texaco was in Ecuador for a long time, like some other oil companies. They got concessions from the Ecuadorian government, and sometimes they exploited their blocks in a coalition with the government company. Ecuador has a government oil company also. Mm-hmm. So sometimes it was kind of they exploited the oil together in a particular block or separately. So there are different kind of contracts that they had. Mm-hmm. But basically, the lawsuit was about Texaco using substandard technology and then strongly polluting the environment and destroying the environment in the Ecuadorian Amazon. While they, like in their fields in the United States and other places, they were using cleaner technology that didn't create those problems. But in order to save a few dollars in Ecuador, they were just like using substandard technology and polluting the land.
That's terrible.
And the pollution destroyed the environment, but also created a lot of illnesses for the people, precluded them from cultivating the land, their animals died, they got sick, many of them with cancer. And it's hard to treat cancer for poor people in Ecuador. There is only one hospital and the hospital is in Quito and they have to travel by bus to Quito to get their chemotherapy. So it was kind of a bad situation in terms of human rights there. So that was what this lawsuit was about. So it started like that. And because of this nationalistic government and so this lawsuit ended in 2011 and Ecuador won the lawsuit. So Texaco was, and then at that time was already Chevron, was asked to pay $90 billion plus, like a big amount of money.
Yeah, that's a big amount.
And the plaintiffs were like the legal team and the Ecuadorian peasants and the indigenous peoples. And also like they had to pay for cleaning the environment there. Uh-huh. Because they had used some pits that were not used in the U.S. or in any other places, where they just dumped the refuse from oil exploitation. Oh, wow. So then, they win, but then Texaco, once they lose the lawsuit in Ecuador, they move the lawsuit again to the United States. And then they accuse the legal team, there was a U.S. legal team led by Steve Dossinger, and they accused the legal team of fraud, of having kind of use false reports, bribe judges in Ecuador, and that there was no due process in Ecuador, and so on and so forth. And then they were able to win the lawsuit in the U.S. So in Ecuador, Chevron is supposed to pay $90 billion. But in the U.S., that lawsuit was declared revolved.
It was null.
Exactly.
Void. Wait. When you say 90 million or 90 billion? Billion?
I think it was 90 billion.
Yeah, it was a large amount. I remember. I don't have
it
that.
It was a large amount. Yeah. But the strategy of Chevron has been very interesting. It has been like moving the lawsuit from one place to the other and delaying, and they have a lot of money for lawyers, and their lawyers are very good. And so that's very interesting. But the later development, so the first lawsuit was 2003 to 2011, and then there was another one from 2011 to 2014, where they nulled the previous in the U.S. And then the Ecuadorians take the lawsuit to Canada and other places because Chevron had properties there.
Yeah.
But so that's still going on as far as I know.
That's impressive.
The other thing is that then the U.S. Bar Association took the license from Dossinger because they said he had committed fraud, like the lawyer of the peasants and the indigenous people. So it's very complicated, but Texaco had a lot of money, could delay forever the lawsuits, and also had additional strategies, like for instance, even paying social scientists to write research that was questioning the point of view of the indigenous people. So I think it's very similar to the strategies of the oil companies with climate change. With climate change, the oil companies kind of funded some research that contradicted what scientists said about climate change to create an environment in which there was doubt. Like people say, well, there is a disagreement between scientists. And actually there was no disagreement. Like all scientists thought climate change was real.
Yeah.
The companies even kind of finance social scientists to claim that, I mean, to create this supposedly scholarly disagreement.
Yeah.
So this is kind of interesting.
That is interesting. You know, over the years, this is the big lawsuit that I've heard about, environmental issue from South America. Granted that I'm not an expert on South American environmental issues or history, but is the indigenous environmental movement and politics in Ecuador more active as represented by this lawsuit than the rest of South America, Latin America?
In my book, I argue that originally the indigenous movement was not so much about environmental rights. Mm-hmm. When they started, they were more about agrarian reform and better labor conditions. They were more like a classical movement of the left, more interested in labor conditions, land rights, and things like that. But my argument in the book is that starting like around 2000, they become more environmentally oriented, and they start to nominate as presidents of the indigenous association people who are environmental activists. And I think it has to do... my argument is that has to do with the rise in the price of commodities in the 21st century. There is a moment in which oil becomes very expensive, but also copper, for instance, that is produced in Ecuador, and gold. And all this has to do with Chinese demand. Like the Chinese economy grows a lot, China has a lot of demand for these commodities, including oil and copper. Copper is very important to the modernization and the infrastructure of China.
Of course,
so
yeah.
So then these governments focus more on extraction of natural resources.
Interesting.
And then the indigenous movement starts to react because mining is very, I mean, the mining of copper and gold pollutes a lot, also uses a lot of water. And I have to say that when the agrarian reform happened in Ecuador, the landowners kept obviously the best, I mean, the rich landowners, the settlers, they kept the best land and they kept most of the water. And the indigenous peasants were kind of pushed to the mountains, to the hills, and they were left with very little water. So water is a big issue. And the mining companies concentrate a lot of the water. So that's another big big problem there. So that's when the indigenous movement, I think, becomes more environmentally concerned.
Yeah, yeah.
And I have to say that China has a big role also, because China, having this interest in oil and copper, starts to directly invest, not only in Ecuador, but in other countries in Latin America.
Yeah, yeah. Let's take a break here. Stay with me and Dr. Martinez Novo as we get into the perspective.
The History Behind News podcast is available on all your favorite podcast platforms. Of course, we love your reviews and ratings of our podcast, especially on Apple and Spotify. And remember, don't keep us to yourself. Tell a friend about the History Behind News podcast.
Dr. Martinez Novo, you know, recently we've heard about the TV station incident in Ecuador and other related issues such as assassination of presidential candidates. That's all politics, and I don't want to get into that so much, as I'm interested to know about Ecuador's organized gangs.
Well, what is happening in Ecuador is very concerning, and I think it's a regional trend in Latin America, wider than Ecuador itself, which is kind of the expansion of the power of organized crime and how they are kind of moving into every part of society. To kind of influencing government, justice system, the police, the military, everywhere. So it's very concerning. What happened in Ecuador, and it also relates in part to the period where Correa was governing. Correa was, as I said, leftist and nationalist, so he decided to close a military base that the United States had in the Ecuadorian coast. And that military base was controlling a lot of the drug traffic. It was located in the city of Manta, and it had radars and stuff. And Correa decides to close this military base because of, like, national sovereignty concerns. So drugs were not traditionally produced in Ecuador, and I think they are not produced to this day, as far as I know. Coca is mostly produced in Peru and in Colombia, but Ecuador is a very important point of distribution and travel of the drug traffic.
Oh, I see.
So it's more like a transit. It's not so much production in Ecuador. So at some point, with the close of the Manta base, there is less ability to control drug trafficking there. And at some point, Correa had an open policy for migration. Then he changed with the kind of incoming Venezuelan migration letter. It was changed. But there was a moment in which there was perhaps not much control, and the American base was closed. And in reality, we are not, like social scientists, we are still learning what is going on, or very kind of puzzled about it. But what happens is that some of the Mexican cartels were able to move there. There are like two factors. Some of the Mexican cartels moved to Ecuador. And also when Colombia signs the peace process with the guerrillas, with the FARC, some of the guerrillas were supporting themselves with drug production and trafficking. And some of the people don't sign the peace agreement, and they become like kind of, they stay being like narco traffickers and don't. So there are like some splinters from the Colombian guerrillas. So you have a mixture between the Mexican cartel, some Colombian guerrillas, and then what the, in my view, the first cartel that moved to Ecuador is the Sinaloa cartel. But now the violence that is produced in Ecuador is because there are several people, I think, several groups trying to fight for control of this territory. And that's what's creating a lot of the violence. The cartels don't work in Ecuador directly, or maybe in part they work directly, but they are also working through local organizations that are these gangs. Mm-hmm. Like, and there are some Ecuadorian gangs, like Los Chone, the Chone Killers, Los Lobos, the Tiguerones. There are a number of Ecuadorian gangs, but basically these gangs work for one of the cartels. The ones that I know, that I have read that are operating in Ecuador now are the Sinaloa cartel and the Cartel Jalisco, I believe Tercera Generación, one of the generations. Yeah. But it's two Mexican cartels, maybe some of the Colombians. I don't know how they come into this. But what has happened is like the problem started in Ecuadorian jails. The drug traffickers were controlling the jails. The government was not controlling the jails. And that happened after Correa's period. There were like two different presidents after that. And now we have a third one. Some assassinations started to happen in jails, like, but I have to say that Ecuador has been a very peaceful country until very recently. Like, you had a very violent Peru, very violent Colombia, but Ecuador was very peaceful. Like, I saw two presidents fall in Ecuador and almost no one was killed. Like, governments would be ousted and without any deaths, or maybe one person who fell from a car, or somebody who had a heart attack because of the fumes. But it was mostly very, very peaceful. But once the cartels move in and they start to work with through these local groups, the first sign was the jails. People started to appear beheaded, or like forms of killing that are not common in Ecuador, that are more typical of what happens in Mexico. That was the beginning. But then people started to be assassinated. There was a presidential candidate that was assassinated last year.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was the mayor of the city of Manta was killed. And people have been assassinated. And there is a case going on that you're a lawyer, you will be interested in. It's called the case a metastasis case because it's like a cancer.
Yeah.
And there is a prosecutor who is fantastic. He's an Ecuadorian woman, a very courageous prosecutor who found this corruption case that includes, the corruption case includes the narcos. Well, the corruption case, she finds out about it because one narco is assassinated in a jail and she gets his phone. And from the phone, he gets all the conversations of this narco person. His name is Norero. And then from his phone, she figures out that he's in contact with, he has paid judges, he has paid police, he has paid politicians, like the whole public system in Ecuador is involved.
Oh my goodness. He
has laundered money. And a lot of some high people who were part of the Correa government are involved in this corruption.
So she's prosecuting this case right now?
She's prosecuting. Obviously, they have threatened her.
Yeah.
And I think she's being protected by the United States right now because the president of Ecuador, because of this situation in which the gangs took even a TV channel live. They took the channel and they have assassinated presidential candidates and all these things that are happening. People are afraid of going to the streets. It's very difficult, the situation. And the current president, Noboa, has declared not only a state of exception, he has declared a state of internal war. That's the declaration that he has made.
Oh, wow, state of internal war.
And he has asked for the help of the United States.
Oh, wow.
Because of this, because the gangs are totally like the government didn't control the jails. People were being assassinated. in the streets, and even high-profile people like presidential candidates. So the situation is very bad. And what he's trying to do is to follow the model of President Bukele of El Salvador, try to build mega jails. But the problem with this is like, the population is afraid of organized crime, but then they ask him to be tough on crime, but then there are violations of human rights that are going on, or because of this crack on crime.
Yeah.
So I think what is very sad is that Ecuador is not exceptional. Is more sadly, I think this what is happening in Mexico and Central America is moving to other places in Latin America.
That's unfortunate. That truly is unfortunate. Dr. Martinez Novo, let's bring our conversation to a close by going back to how we started this conversation, the people of Ecuador. In the minute we have left, if you wanted our audience to remember just one point after everything we've talked about the people of Ecuador, what would it be?
Well, I think with all the problems that we have discussed, but I think in my view is Ecuador is a fantastic, beautiful country. The nature is amazing. Like you have the Galapagos Islands, you have the Amazon jungle, you have very high, the highest volcanoes in the Andes. So the natural diversity is amazing. The cultural diversity, all these people speak in different languages, the political history of the country. So it's absolutely fascinating, and the people are the most hospitable and nice people to receive. They are going through like a hard time now with the with the organized crime moving on there, but I think it's a remarkable country, and I would encourage everyone to visit if they can.
For sure, for sure. Maybe when the situation is a little bit better, right? Mm-hmm. Dr. Martinez Novo, thank you so much for educating me and our listeners. And to our listeners, if you know of any history that could provide more perspective from the past on this subject, please share it with us and tell us what's your perspective. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, Adele, for the opportunity to share with your audience.
For sure. For sure.
The opinions and statements of our guests are their own. We neither agree nor disagree with them. We're only interested in the perspective they provide through history. At History Behind News, we're honored that our guests share their expertise with us, most of which are based on years of scholarship and research, and we provide links to their projects and publications for your benefit to review them if you wish. Otherwise, we're not affiliated with our guests. We just think they teach us pretty cool history, the history behind our news. Also, unless we explicitly inform you, we're not affiliated with any institutions, including Amazon, for which book links are shared here from time to time for your convenience. Finally, as a reminder, we don't do news here at History Behind News. We peel the news for the history behind it. And our mission is not to provide a complete account and analysis of the past, rather is to highlight some issues and incidents in our history that may poke and prod your discerning minds into seeking some perspective for our news. And if you disagree with our take on history, well then, it means we've succeeded in getting you to think about the history behind news. And of course, share your thoughts with me by leaving your comments on Twitter or sending an email to adele@historybehindnews.com. I love to hear from you. I love to learn from you. Until next time, this is Adele with History Behind News, a history podcast for our news.